decade, although this is a long list because I can't remember this many names.
I know. Yeah, this was tough. Ben McKnight and Kaylor and I did this a couple weeks ago, and we thought it was a lot of fun, just kind of going back and looking who are the players you most associate with this decade. So I have a list. I know Ben has a list. I'm sure you don't, Matt. So we can...
No, guaranteed I do not have a list.
We can start off from those lists and then go from there if we would like. I know there was some controversy. There was some back and forth here. Personally, I had Johan as the far and away winner of Player of the Decade.
Player of the Decade?
Yeah, the person who most defined, who you most associate with this play. And I think Drew won more Nationals in this time.
Really?
But... Drew has four, three with Palmer, one with Gambino.
Yep.
But I think Johan has three, one with Albrecht, two with Parsons, I think is correct. We're gonna run with three, and then so Drew has more, and then I think Parsons also has four because he won with Stulak, two with Johan, and then one with Juan. But Johan, the way he like the athleticism, the style he brought to the game, every time you play him, I think he's still for me. I view him as the player of the decade, or the most impactful one, at least.
Yeah, I had Parsons.
You had Parsons one.
Yeah, but you know, when I first sent this to you, though, you said the decade, and I didn't think 2010 onwards. I was thinking that I don't know. I just
you're in your
last,
bubble. You're in your.
I was in my
your,
own bubble, and I did my own thing, and I put Mansinger and Goodspeed in there because they were right on the edge of that 2007, 2008, 2009. They were kind of coming up, so it was outside of that. But I had them in there. But then you've got to have. You know, obviously Durant, Broderick, but, you know, Hughes, Powers have to be in there. That season, we talked about this the other day. That season they had a couple of years back where they didn't lose.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Best season ever.
Yeah.
Has to be, right? And then, obviously, Palmer and Araya.
Yeah. I think those are good. I think I also have Gambino is a sneaky one in there because you don't think of Gambino necessarily, but, I mean, he won a Nationals this decade. And then with Matic, he was top five in the country for a couple years. And in Chicago League, you know, you never want to be playing Gambino. You know, he's just been so consistently good the whole decade. It's that one for me. And then DeRose, the one who never won Nationals, but everyone knows, like, DeRose is one of the most talented, one of the best players to play. And I don't think I still think I've never beaten DeRose. I think that might be.
Really?
We haven't played in a tournament in a long time, but he is
always a threat.
Graham, you're talking to us now. You will win.
He might not be playing that much anymore. He might have just taken his chips, toys, and gone home.
It will be interesting to see if the paddle hex bump still applies to Graham as he's now part of the team.
It did last week.
I already used it up.
I already congratulated him.
You wasted it.
On Pittsburgh.
Come on, Graham.
The other one, Graham, you had on your list, who is a sneaky one that I didn't think of, but he's been... a great player for the last 10 years, Pete Rose.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Consistency. Yeah, he was like top eight in the country for the first 7 years of the decade. With
Ben McKnight.
Yeah, always in the quarterfinals and Nationals. And then since then, he, you know, was just like, all right, I'll get someone younger and I'll, with my own last name, we'll have this brother thing going on. And they've been top six in the country the past year or so. And they're great. They beat us last year at Charities. They're Pete's, and I mean, I don't think there's a better league player. I think between him and Adam Morgan, they might be the best two league players in the country for me.
Well, I got to tell you, when my first year playing Series 1, I played for Glenview Club. And the year before and that year, Pete, I want to say, had won 33 matches in a row. Ooh. On Court 1, Series 1.
Yeah, that's
impressive.
Unparalleled. That's pretty good.
That's easy.
Yeah.
Have you ever lost a match on Court 1, Series 1?
I've never lost a match on Court 1, Series 1.
Good
ever.
Job, dude.
There
ever.
It is.
That's awesome.
Undefeated.
Oh, so I'm just checking my list. Actually, I had Matt one above Pete, so that actually makes sense.
I don't know how we missed that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because you guys are high. yeah, from that perspective, I mean, obviously, you know, it's tough to put him in any kind of order. I feel like sometimes from the you know, if you take a step back, as obviously we play a bunch of tournaments and we're kind of in it all the time, but I also view it from kind of like a recognizable, you know, player kind of personality. I mean, Juan has to be pretty close to the top of the list because he's been around for a long time and everybody knows who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably some, you know, kind of element to that. I agreed with Gambino because I feel like he's another one that comes up all the time, like as an example, you know, for people. You know, so there's a few on that side that, you know, I totally agree with. Burka, I think, ends up making my list of players only because he's another one that, like, for an extended period of time has been, you know, competing. He's at all the tournaments. He, you know, he always makes a run and does well. He's like kind of always, you know, around. And so that's kind of an interesting one that I, you know, might. But for the most part, I think you guys nailed it.
Thank you.
Ladies' side.
The last 10, you've got to start with Dardis and Shea, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I don't think they've never won a Nationals, though.
Gotten close a lot, but I don't think they've ever won one.
But you've got to look at them as the kind of the top two in the last.
Yeah.
Right.
When talking about longevity, I don't think there's another team or another players. I know Kerry Delmonico probably fits in that same group in terms of like longevity, always at the top, whatever partner she's playing with. But most of the other players didn't start playing, like the Vickies and the Annas and the Gabbies and all that. They didn't start playing until later in the decade. Dardis and Shea have been there the whole time, and they've been very, very highly ranked, you know, the whole
time.
Yeah.
And then you've got Heather Prop.
Absolutely.
Out of Cincinnati. And then I know Laura Berendt and Annika, I think it was Cooper at the time, but they, I think it was almost 10 or 11 years ago, they won charities or they did really well in maybe a final of Nationals, but they're both back. They took a long time off. They had kids and took 6 or 8 years off and then came back, and they're both kind of the top players again. Mm-hmm. So you need to include them. But then you got some of the other ones now. Roxy.
Yep.
Last 3 or 4 years. Gabby,
yeah. She's been the best, I think, for the last 3 or 4 years. Vicky, I remember when Vicky and Anna, the Ovas, as they called them, when they first started playing, I want to say in 2012, maybe, they couldn't lose. I mean, they were unbelievable. So I think they both should definitely be on there.
Nice. You have anything to add, Matt?
Weren't we just talking about a team winning a whole bunch of West Penns? We were just discussing it. Yeah, Jess and Kelly, right?
Kelly Fisher, yeah, they've won 12. I think we did the math of the last 14. There was an injury and a loss there. They've won 12 West Penns.
That's pretty impressive, you know, even though it's in one specific, you know, tournament, Grand Prix level tournament, you know, it's still pretty amazing to have that kind of run, even if it's at a home tournament.
Yeah, this weekend, I think Kelly Fisher, she hit a great overhead, a really hard flat, kind of a Marino-esque overhead, and I was watching with Scott Kaler, and he goes, "Ooh, that was a good bitch slap." And I was like, excuse me? He's like, that's what you call a bitch slap. I was like, nice.
So I will tell you, different shots are viewed differently in different areas of the country.
Absolutely.
So I was playing the final of Kansas City a couple of years ago. We'd lost the first set, and we were, you know, kind of not doing great. And I was like, well, we need to amp this up a little bit. Short lob came in, and I FYM'd Peter Hantak, the guy out of St. Louis, really good dude. I FYM Peter. I hit it so hard. I caught it great. It came up, clipped him in the stomach, and we won the point. The, I don't know, 75, 80, whatever people behind the court all started booing me. Straight up booing me.
The evil Chicago guy coming in,
hitting
their players.
Like, they did nothing.
You tool.
Yeah, and then on the changeover, Peter like high fives me. He's like, that was a good shot. I go, you're going right back at me, aren't you? He's like, yep. But yeah, it was interesting to me that outside of Chicago, the FYM was not a popular shot. I was just talking about this last night. I was playing a match with Dave, and Dave was like, if anyone, the guy started lob blitzing. And he's like, if they come in, tell me which one it is and I will hit them. And so they do not come in again. I was like, oh, okay. And then I told him, I played a match about a year or two ago, and a short lob came up. And as I'm looking up to it, I can feel the guy come blitzing in. I was like, no, he's not. I saw him. I hit him so hard right in the chest. And he was angry. Bad. Yeah. And I looked, I'm like, dude, you lob blitzed on a short lob. You're an idiot.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm going to hit you. But I know there is a guy in the Chicago area that, and he's told me this, he will not say sorry when he hits you because he's like, I meant to hit you. Why would I say sorry? I'll ask you, you're okay.
Yeah.
Are you okay? I hope I didn't hurt you, but I was trying to hit you. So why would I say sorry for something I was trying to do?
This is one official's big things here at every live stream. It's like, why am I apologizing? I got a neck cord and I won the point. I'm sorry, I guess. Like I hit you. I'm sorry, I guess. Like,
I think it's kind of left over from tennis, right? Where you kind of there's a piece where you know you win a point and you're not going to give the point back, but there's also a recognition that maybe it wasn't clean, right? Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't the most honorable way to win a point, and so I think that's where it changes. And I disagree to a certain extent with never apologizing, because there are times where I'm trying to hit somebody and then they move, and like I hit a guy like in the eye a couple years ago. And while I was going to put it in his chest, he took a weird step and all of a sudden got real low. And I felt bad because I wasn't trying to hit him in the face.
Yeah.
But that was also not the time to be like, hey, let's move
toughen
on.
Up.
Yeah. Like that's not the
get the eye patch.
The play.
Let's go.
Right.
Well, that happened at the Nationals final this year. John Hughes lined up and cracked a big forehand, and Mark Parsons ducked into it and hit him in the head.
Yeah.
And then actually Mark then hit John a few games later the same play, and neither of them meant to hit each other in the head.
No, but that's a risk, right? Is that you're going big at somebody's body and they decide I'm going to try to get out of the way of this, and if they can't, like you're exposed, but I don't think you should feel good about detaching someone's retina.
All right, let's start. Let's have a go with this one. Predicting the next decade.
Yeah, what's paddle going to look like over the next 10 years?
Interesting. Well, let's. Can we skip a skip down one? And I think that may help answer the next this question.
Mm-hmm.
In that, I think the next player of the decade is. This depends if he wants to play tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
Out of Chicago, I'm going to use Chicago because who we see the most. Robert Steinman.
Oh, yeah.
Is going to be good.
I'm playing with him tomorrow.
Are you?
See that in person, yeah.
I beat Robert about a year or so ago. I am never playing him ever again.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
never.
It's tricky because it's always a matter of with paddle, like these great tennis players, are they going to stick with it? Like, are they going to play? And like what's, I don't know, a lot of them are great. They're a flash and they kind of get bored and then they move on. Steinman's a good one. I think there's a couple. I think Hughes and Powers are still going to be here in 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
I think they're crazy. I think I'm crazy enough to still be here. Chris Humphreys, a big one out of Connecticut now. I think that is making waves. He's had a lot of good results this year. Everyone's talking about him as being kind of the next good player coming out of that area.
A lot of these guys are getting older though. Like I just played.
That'll be so interesting. Yeah. How long can they hang on?
Well, I played the charities 90s. And the draw was strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, like everyone's starting to get in that 40 to 45, like, you know, like Parsons is what, I think he's the same age as me. I think he's 40 or 41.
Yeah, all
Juan,
the top
Juan
players.
Juan is in the 40s. Johan's in his 40s. Yeah.
Drew's in the same. So it'll be very interesting to see, you know, assuming how long can they hang on and who else steps up.
Yeah, so, I think you, Powers, and Hughes, probably the three main guys who are playing right now, right? That were probably...
I'm trying to think of the other young
years.
Ones. We're the only ones in our 20s. There's a
How
lot
old
of like
is
low.
Max?
Max, I want to say, is mid-30s.
Is
low
he?
Yeah.
He looks young.
Oh, yeah. He's a handsome-looking guy. Stays in great shape. Compton is another young 30s one who could be around a while. Bostrom's not that old. Kaler's low to mid-30s. So
Don't get Matt started on Brian Compton.
Oh, yeah. I've heard.
Yeah.
Or he might be in jail by that time.
He'll be caught, God willing. from a weird perspective in terms of anticipating the future, like there is a chance that it looks exactly like it does now with, and we can talk about whether we keep this or not. So keep this in the back of your head, but whether it looks exactly the same now with the PFP folded into it in terms of the future of the game.
Yeah.
Right. With that you start to go like, you know what, there's 10 tournaments a year where the people that are good play for money. And then there's everybody else. And whether that includes some version of the PTI having to do with, your 10 through, 18 or whatever, they decided to mix the numbers up as and create an A, B, and a C nationals or that kind of thing. I think that in a decade with some of that stuff hammered out, I think that it does grow the sport to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But I think that it gets worse before it gets better. Like I see the potential turmoil over the next 3 years being much more difficult than what they're anticipating, right? With just kind of rolling it out, because there is already a little bit of a lull in terms of some participation, like even within local markets, like that charities is not full, every year because guys don't want to get the shit kicked out of them. And especially like good players that are like not going to come out because they're like, I am just going to get destroyed by everyone.
Yep.
And so there's, there's kind of two different tournaments already going on within those events. And so I think that there's some, I think they have to go through a little bit of a recovery period, you know, if they start to separate out those really high-level players and decide how they're going to handle that, and whether the PFP comes into the fold or not is another, you know, kind of piece of the puzzle. But I think ultimately, like, if we look back and do the 2030 year, you know, decade in review, I think that it's all folded together and has started to shape more like USTA tennis is what I think, mm-hmm. like, is the general direction that it goes, with a small caveat to how big the APTA pushes the outreach in different markets, right? Because if you know, Chicago's big because you got public courts, right? You got park sure. districts in Chicago that are going to pick up facilities and the finance that goes along with it, and it's going to promote more, you know, pros, players, access, and so it gets to be this, you know, this giant thing. And if the APTA starts to front, you know, some of the whatever resources, you know, mm-hmm. grants, however they handle it, and create that in some other markets, then the sport will continue to grow.
Now, I don't want to give ourselves too much of a compliment, but we're kind of in the first part of a movement to be a little different in the game.
Yeah.
Paddle's always kind of been like, all right, it's old rich white dudes that hang out at country clubs and...
And we've changed that by not being rich?
Yeah.
I am not that old.
No, we've kind of... This has always pushed a little bit towards a slightly different of the demographic of paddle players, and I think where the game's moving, it's getting a lot younger, and you know, it's a little more dynamic, and I think you and I think when we started this, we're kind of surprised no one had done it before. Mm-hmm. And as it kept going, I'm like, I can't believe no one else has even stepped up. And
but it also makes perfect sense because there's not that millennial that many millennials playing.
Yeah. As far as the playing side, do you think, Graham, not you, because I'm not talking to you when it comes to playing, Matt. But
Did I offend you just recently within this last comment?
Do you think the volley's going to be more, people are going to get more aggressive with the volleys? It always used to be so just put it back. And I was watching the charities final the other day, and you're seeing guys really sticking volleys to kind of get low right at that snowboard and you know, just being more aggressive with the volley.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think it's kind of been underutilized. A lot of my game is moving around at the net, putting more pressure on my opponent, trying to take time away, like volley early, volley behind him, volley at him, volley to space, just to create more. I think forever it was, you know, the Gambinos who were so complacent to sit off the net and make their volley and then, you know, make you drive again. But I think from, like, not to get too nerdy, but from, like, an efficiency standpoint, a drive is a much more efficient shot than a volley. Like, you lose more points off of volleys than you win more points. You win more points off of ground strokes than you lose more points. So I think there's a lot of room there for players. Like, I think probably Alex was probably one of the first ones, Vancia from now in Cleveland, formerly Chicago, to say, hey, like, I don't only have to volley defensively. I can also get on top of the net and roll this ball in behind you or drop shot it. Like, a lot of players have great drop shots. I think the volley is definitely one of the shots where people can start turning up the pace a little bit instead of just being complacent with putting the ball back in the court.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
I think another shot similar to that is the lob. I've thought for a long time that we all need to learn how to hit topspin lobs. Because when you look at a player like Mark Powers or Jared Palmer, they can take their forehand grip, and John Hughes does it too, and they can line up and show you a forehand and then hit a lob. And it's not that they're hitting a great topspin lob that lands on the back of the line. All they're doing is creating a half second longer of indecision, so you don't know, should I close? Should I back up? What shot should I expect? So then all that does is that makes your opponent a little bit more stretched. They make it reach a little bit farther. So then you get a better ball to drive on the next shot. I think players, if you can drive with the same grip you can lob, and again, do not, I'm not recommending you go out there and miss lobs, because if you're missing a lob, that is about the worst
error you can make.
Is the worst error you can make. But if you're capable of it, hitting a lob and a forehand with the same grip, you're going to find that your lobs are going to be more effective every time you hit it, because your opponents are just going to hesitate. They're going to be frozen, and then they're going to have to hit it off their back foot. And then that might give you the next shot where you can take advantage of it. So I'm looking for a lot more players, you know, work on your topspin lobs, guys. You know?
I think of the two big evolutions that you're seeing in terms of, you know, people being willing to use their athleticism a little bit more to manufacture shots is one that I feel like decisions now get made based on balance rather than perfect positioning from the backcourt, right? Like, I have seen people drive balls from all over the place at every level. Mm-hmm. And, like, what I've started to tell people is, like, if you have your balance and you are, you know, you've set up early and you've done all the things correctly, like, give it a ride. Go for it. Because, you know, as long as you're not swinging so hard that you can't then regain balance to track down the next ball, fine. And it, you're right. It used to be lob from the green and drive from the blue, and that's how you play paddle. And while that is certainly has its place, I think that at the club level, you know, you're trying to kind of maximize, you know, strengths and minimize weaknesses. And then I think the net position at the club level is much more... The movement and aggression with the movement and the positioning is only going to increase.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, you get somebody who's willing to shift all over the place, who's willing to cut off drives with their volley by moving all the way across the court. Like, that person didn't really have a lot to do in the past. And now it's like, no, if you can get over there and hit a volley from right on top of the net, like, do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's started to become... At least I'm seeing, you know, my players and a bunch of our other opponents do a real good job, you know, that where it used to be super simple standing there. Now they're moving the ball around more and they're, you know, they're following and, mm-hmm. and correctly positioning themselves better.
And Graham, I'll tell you, when Matt and I, we've traveled around to a number of camps, paddle's not always taught one way now. Mm-hmm. Like, Matt and I will often start our camps by saying, listen, we may tell you a couple of different things. Neither are wrong, but there's just ways that people play that work differently for others. Like, we have a difference of opinion on who the caller should be, as an example. But I just think there's a lot of good pros out there now, and the game's being taught a number of different ways. But at the club level, there's some good stuff. You're smiling because you know what I'm thinking about with people teaching differently. But
well, just from a final point, it's fascinating.
Floating eye.
I had somebody call me out recently. I'm like, you told her to do this and you told me to do that. And I was like, yeah, it's because you're two fucking different people. Yeah. Like what? I'm just supposed to, like, give you the corporate line over and over? Like, no, it's not the same. Mm-hmm. Like, you drive your backhand, she drives her forehand. You have a great overhead, she does not. Like, mm-hmm. you're going to do different stuff in order to be successful, and that's okay. Really good coaches are good at picking out the spots where they can maximize an individual player's talent.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunately not the same across the board.
I was like on indoor tennis facilities and you see the coach going, you need to hit your forehand like Nadal. And you're like, fuck, you're an idiot. No, you don't.
So many steroids. You have to do so many steroids before next week.
We're just going to get to every episode talking about steroids. Do you have anything to add?
I have one more, and this might tie in better with the top end, like the topspin lob, so we might put that there. But another shot that I think is going to be huge that we've already seen it happening, and I think this is the biggest one by far, is the forehand or the underhand serve, whether that be a bump, whether that be a roller, a topspin, sidespin. A couple years ago, it was really only Adam Morgan, Will Colmar, and Paolo Gonzalez were the only three people in the country doing it. This year, I've seen Johan do it. I've seen Stephen Mitchell do it. I've seen Mick Erdoya do it. I've seen Jeff Morneau. I've seen Martin Bostrom. I just on the live stream last night. And it's still at the point where everybody's faulting. So they're kind of nervous.
Roxy and Ika?
Roxy's doing it. Everyone's faulting a little bit, so they're a little too nervous. But I think it's almost a no-brainer. I actually feel stupid. I wish I had a court where I can go practice it more, because just from the perspective of I'm going to get my opponent to hit a flat return instead of being able to drive down at my feet and give me more time to volley, I think it's a no-brainer. People need to start hitting more rollers, more underhand serves. I think at some point we need to just start teaching it to club level. Like, if I, let's say I'm a pro and I've had a member who's never played tennis before, never hit an overhand serve, I'd be like, all right, let's just not establish that habit. Let's just start you hitting a normal topspin forehand and coming to the net, and then starting from the point from there. I'm so curious, because already we're seeing it, so many new players. In 5 years from now, is it going to be weird to hit an overhand serve?
We played a couple of practice sets earlier today with Padgett and Chris over at Skokie, and the only volley that Padgett missed while hitting an underhand serve was if we clipped the let cord on the return. Mm-hmm. I mean, he legitimately made 100% of the volleys with the exception of the three that clipped the tape and went, like, it's just, we sprayed some long, we missed a couple in the top of the tape, we were still trying to be aggressive, but it's just, it keeps it in that strike zone. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know. It'll be interesting to see what the evolution is.
Mm-hmm.
potential mm-hmm. rule changes for the evolution of paddle? Or you were just saying that this is more of like a culture change almost, or Graham was in some capacity.
Yeah, so the first one is more of a rule change, and then Ben's, which I wholeheartedly agree with, is more of a culture change. But the first rule change is if you hit a lob and that lob is good enough to land in the court and then proceed to exit the court, under no circumstance should you ever lose a point. I don't even care if it's 70 degrees, 80 degrees. As an opponent, I should be able to tell, you know, is this lob, does it have a chance of going out? Is it going in, whatever it is, can it bounce out? If you're good enough to hit the ball that high, that deep in the court, that it bounces, and by the way, your opponents, you have a chance to hit it. You can play it if you want to. You're choosing not to. You choose to let it bounce, and then the ball goes out. I don't see why we're punishing people for hitting really good, really high lobs. It happened this weekend in Pittsburgh where Faletek hit a great lob in a big point, landed on the line, and bounced out, and we all were like, wow, this sucks. Like, that was a great shot. I don't know why that's a loss of point. I get the principle of it. You bounced it in, you bounced it out, but...
Yeah, I'm going to play devil's advocate with this one.
Oh, no.
Just for entertainment, not because
I don't disagree
with you. I'm only going to play devil's advocate.
Okay.
You hit a shot. It's a, you know, super high lob. Doesn't it also require a certain amount of court awareness at the level that we all play to let a ball bounce in the hope that it goes out of bounds to win a free point versus just giving up the net?
Kind of.
You know what I mean? Because if it stays in play, like, let's go from the other version, right? Somebody hits kind of a waterfall overhead, right, from up close. And you have made a move in which you're thinking about cutting it off, but you feel like the angle is too sharp, and you're like, oh, this is going to bounce out of the screen, and you let it go to win the free point. Mm-hmm. Is that different?
Yes, in the sense that when I play, if someone hits a lob that's that high and that deep, I will never be taking it out of the air to begin with, because only bad things can happen by me playing that overhead.
Right.
And so it's not even the fact that I'm thinking, I mean, I am partially thinking the ball could bounce out, but even if that wasn't an option, I'm kind of going at it the other way. I would let it bounce because hitting the overhead there is just a bad shot. You're out of position. They hit a great lob. They're probably going to drive the next ball. You're in no man's land. You're better off just giving you and your partner time to retreat. So right. It actually adds another level in the sense that not only am I not hitting this because it's the right thing to do, and not only am I not hitting this because it could go out, now it's I have to play this shot because their lob is so good and so deep, they should be rewarded for it. So I have to make a decision. Oh, shoot, I got to play this even though I would normally back up because they just hit that good of a lob and they might win the point if it bounces out.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is true, though, that it, like, until you get to that level, it's a realization, because most people just want to hit every lob they can get their hands on, you know?
Yeah.
But then you get to the level where it's like, I don't want to hit this lob anyway. Now I have to hit the lob. So it is kind of like at a top level, it's a little bit different of a conversation than at a more club level, I think, to your point.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see. I don't know. We should play a set and see what happens.
We do it in the summer where if that happens, no one intentionally does it. But if you do it and it lands in and goes out, it's not a loss of point. You win the point.
Yeah. I'm curious to see if it was a rule, like if it would be abused, like if you could get people to just start to nuke balls.
Let's do it.
And be like, that's what I'm saying. Like, we should play a set with under those guidelines. First of all, I think that paddle in its purest form being played in the winter, I think it's impossible. Right. Like, I think if it's 20 degrees.
20, yeah.
Yes.
It'd be an impressive feat.
Yes, it would be amazing for you to bounce a ball
more out. To the point that you should win.
Maybe. Yeah. And then the flip side is it happens all the time during summer league. And then, you know, then I go like, well, they made a summer ball for this reason. Like, we're choosing not to play with it because you guys all complain about it's too heavy or whatever. But they did take this into account.
Yeah.
So in the rare instance, I don't know. I just I think it would be an interesting change because I feel like part of the strategy is the, you know, the court awareness to say, like, this shot, like, based on the rules, this shot is about to go out.
Yep.
And so it just becomes part of that thing. But what do you think, Benny?
I'm in that camp.
I think it's a high quality lob.
Yeah. No, I'd never thought about it, actually, to be honest, until we talked about it this afternoon.
So I've won him over. We had a debate. We didn't even know it, but
no,
I won.
No, but
no,
yeah.
I think it's a fair play. Well, that's kind of where I'd go. Do we want to touch on the one you got very excited about?
Oh, please. Preach to me, Benjamin.
I think we've discussed this before, right? Because I have a very strong opinion on this.
This was early in the first season, within the first few episodes.
And I may have said fuck you to everyone that does this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Foot falters.
Yeah.
Fucking assholes. All of them.
They're cheaters, aren't they? I mean, like, at their purest form, they're cheating.
Yeah.
That implies that there's an awareness of it occurring. So we had this discussion, just to recap the discussion, if somebody foot faults and you say, hey, you got to watch your feet, you're foot faulting, let's play a let, how they handle that moment tells you everything about what type of player they are.
Yeah.
Because the person that goes like, oh my God, I'm really sorry, I had no idea that I was like that far out in the court, right? If they go like, sorry, like I will, you know, please keep an eye on it. Let me know. Like, I feel bad, because those are the rules, right? Then you get people that are like, fuck you.
Those people.
Yeah. That's a totally different animal. I will say that I think there's value to having it be a system where it's a warning before it becomes because I've also seen some shitty stuff set points where somebody goes, foot fault, set over. And it's like, no. think we're done, you're out of your mind.
I always like to do it on a changeover. I don't call people for their foot faults. And I have two specific rules, too. If they are under 6 feet, I will never call you on a foot fault, even though please play by the rules.
That's heightism.
And if you are left-handed and you foot fault on me, I'm calling a foot fault. You're already left-handed. What? Why do I need to give you multiple advantages at one time
here?
You're
already a lefty.
I was playing in Atlanta the other week, and I was playing against a 6'2" lefty with a big serve to the deuce side. And I'm like, that's it. You've reached my limit, Cam. You are foot faulting. Please cease. But I'll do it on changeovers or tell the person. But it's so weird that there's this whole fear about telling a person they're foot faulting, as long as you do it in a non-confrontational manner. Because it is a rule. Just follow the rule. We're all adults here. Just let the person know and then move on. But it is so prickly. Maybe
I think the guys that grew up with a really good tennis background don't foot fault. Because in tennis, it's such a big thing.
Yeah, you're so aware of it. Oh, yeah, it's a fault. You spend so much time.
Go in just a centimeter in tennis and you foot fault, they'll call you on it. And that's not an advantage, really, in tennis. But you get guys foot faulting in paddle, and it's such
advantage.
A small court. I don't think as much in, say, Series 1. Mm-hmm. I think guys are better. But I've played some Series 3 this year, and I'm seeing guys like 6'3", 6'4". They're 2 feet inside the court before they're hitting. So when I'm hitting returns and they're hitting balls from waist height, which should be around their knees, that's the difference between my partner blitzing or not blitzing and the point being over.
I think maybe
foot faulters.
Maybe this is a be the change you want to see in the world type moment, where from now on us as podcasters and you as a loyal listener just need to say, hey, I'm going to let people know they're foot faulting from now on a changeover, play a let, not on a big point. And then we can just start all having the conversation that we all know we need to be having.
Yeah. And I will admit that the social aspect of it is like will have pros and cons.
Yes.
Right. Like,
oh,
I mean, because I also play matches sometimes where somebody's foot faulting the whole time. But it's not gonna make a difference. I'm sorry. I don't want to. You know,
sir, do you want to serve from the service line? Because at this point, go ahead.
Right, who, and you're not like what the result is going to be. The result, the 3 inches that you're gaining is not like
my favorite.
Know? And so it's interesting when push comes to shove that the times that you should say something are also the times you don't. Right,
100%.
Because you're like, well, This result's going to be identical, whether you're foot faulting or not.
My favorite is the guy that's bouncing the ball, and his foot is like half
already
over the line already. He can even see his foot as he's bouncing the ball. I'm like, dude, you know you're already foot faulting.
100%.
Like, cheat.
Maybe he was going to take a step backwards.
No, he's not. He's
got a little bit of a run up.
I'm gonna. There's a few people that I'm going to let off the hook, right? And we talked about it during the previous season as well. People who have developed their game with pros or coaches that have talked about, you know, the movement happening, right?
Yeah,
like pushing forward and then making contact before your foot touches the ground. Not everybody has the skill to do that, and yet there's a fair amount of pros out there that have taught to serve that way, right? And so shame on them for not saying, like, hey, heads up, like you are for sure cheating right now because you're taking the step before you touch the ball. But I also think that
that's a tough one
be...
for a club pro to tell their members that they're foot faulting.
Right.
I'll tell you, I think we spoke about this in the last one. There was a guy at my club he was from this other club, and he was stepping with his left foot into the court and then bringing his right leg through. He was almost 6 feet inside the court before he even hit the ball. And he came off the court, and I introduced myself. I said who I was as a pro. Listen, I was like, I'm not getting involved in your match. It's over. But I just want to let you know, your foot, it's not even close. Your foot faulting with your left foot and then like 6 feet with the right foot. No, I'm not. And he named his pro. He goes, he taught me this serve. And I go, I understand. I know who your pro is. He's a friend of mine. I understand he taught you that serve, but his timing is impeccable. And yours, sir, tonight was nowhere near. And he goes, no, I wasn't foot faulting. He taught me this serve. And we had a slow-mo video of him doing it. And he looked at it. He goes, oh,
yeah, oh, this is really bad. You almost have to have the evidence. Yeah. I would say 90% of people will be like, no, maybe once accidentally, but it couldn't have been that bad. And then when you're like, nope, every single time, every one of them, they freak out.
Important PSA here for all the players who I am playing. On my deuce court side serve, I am not foot faulting. Me personally, we have looked at the video. People have challenged this. I hit the ball and then my foot contacts, and I understand I'm 6'4 and I'm kind of breaking my own rule here, but it is a clean legal serve, and I will not, you can't call it, you can't prove it, I will accept I accept no evidence. Don't you dare call this on me next time.
Now, so here's one. Have you ever mistimed it and called it on yourself?
No.
Or have you caught the ball? If your toss was that bad where you were going to foot fault, you catch.
I'll catch the ball. But yeah, to your point, it does, like, I mean, it's like a split second difference for me. So there is I'm sure there's a non-zero chance. There's almost a 100% chance I've accidentally foot faulted before. But I've never have consciously do it. And if I consciously foot faulted, I'm such a stickler that I would certainly call it on myself.
And there it is. I have done it before accidentally. Uh-huh. And that's what everyone thinks about
impeccable timing,
themselves.
Matthew. Impeccable timing.
That's what everyone thinks about themselves. I have done it never intentionally. Nobody is on purpose stepping over the line.
Mm-hmm.
However,
I disagree with
that
statement, but okay.
They are not as aware of it as they should be.
Yes.
And by ignoring it, it only gets worse.
Well, agreed. We were in the hut talking about this last night, because I think foot faults must get brought up in every hut at least once a week around the country. And Dave Kevens is talking about, we were talking about foot faults, and he was talking about Drew Eberle.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, Drew steps when he serves, and guys had caught him a foot fault. He's like, no, I'm not foot on. And then there was a picture in APTA magazine of Drew hitting the serve, and the ball's in the air. He's nowhere near hitting it, and his foot's like 2 feet inside the court. And they're like, yes, we got him.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
There we go. Foot faulted.
Don't you think there's two players on every team that foot fault at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah, two players on a side of the net who foot fault every
yes.
Like, and I'm not even talking just club. Like, I'm talking even tournaments. Like, at the briefly, the APTA tried to kind of crack down on it, and then they kind of put their foot up against. Well, now we have the chair umpire, so presumably they're calling it. But
I don't get the chair umpires.
I've played round of 32, round of 16 matches where my opponents foot fault egregiously, and I might even be losing the match, and I still won't call it on them because I'm just afraid of the confrontation, and I think that's stupid. So I'm going to be the change I wish to see in the world. I'm going to start calling all you guys on foot faults, but don't you dare call it on me. Don't you dare.
We're going to get lit up by Graham McNerney. Early rounds in a tournament.
Foot fault.
You're getting your warning now, folks.
That's right. You and I play in the second round of an event. You're going to kick the shit out of me either way, and you're still going to call me for a foot fault. What a dick.
Yeah.